Welcome to KISS FAQ Song Stories. Though to be fair, this episode should be called Songless Stories.
Ladies and gentlemen, the hottest band in the land, KISS!
In this special episode, we'll focus on KISS at Midnight, the period surrounding KISS's first homecoming to New York City. This event celebrates its 50th anniversary on March the 21st, in conjunction with the release of the band's third studio album. It marked another step up the ladder on their quest for stardom, and set the stage for what fun promotions David Forrest suggested for them becoming the new American super headliner of 1975. The release date for the new album slipped from Casablanca's initial early March target, hardly surprising with the condensed and aggressive recording timeline being pursued. Combined with their pending stream of product releases and desperate financial straits, the release of Dress to Kill took on additional importance to both band and label. Having started recording the album in early February 1975, the group moved at a rapid pace, writing and recording as if their lives depended on it. Certainly their careers did. During the final stretch of work on the new album, KISS undertook a three-day mini-tour that illustrated the new status they were pursuing. As the urgency on their creative demands lessened, the dates saw the band moving up to larger venues that they could headline. They were no longer satisfied just being an opening act and wanted to control their own destiny. The February the 20th date at the nearly sold-out Kiel Auditorium in St. Louis was received warmly, as noted by the Post-Dispatch critic. They wrote, "The fans had come to see KISS, a New York quartet that deals in devil dancing set to simple rock music. The New Yorkers, dressed in basic black leather, gave the crowd what it wanted: explosions, smoke, and flashing lights. Their showmanship and choreography were well done." The following night, the group blew apart the Aragon Ballroom in Chicago. That show was attended by Rolling Stone magazine scribe David Witz, who provided a suitably press release-worthy review in that magazine's April issue. It was published under the title, "KISS and Hello People, Whiteface Rock." It was a timely appearance in the mainstream press, but it wasn't an outlier. David noted, "'Twas the first semi-warm day of the year, and the teens were leaning just a little too heavily into the plate glass window next to the Aragon. So when the cherry bomb went off by the curb, well, accidents will happen. It's only rock and roll. Inside, the seething representatives of Chicago's working-class freakdom put up with man, bounced and jounced with the James Gang, and blew themselves away with KISS." Such writing paints a vivid scene of the time, and one can almost imagine the frenzied crowd at these early shows, when the energy was palpable and one could almost taste the grease paint. As far as Rolling Stone went, they weren't yet the enemy. The album also received a positive review in the July issue. Gordon Fletcher wrote at that time, "KISS does not play music. It makes very high-volume noise. If rock and roll intrigues you, though, you'd best be advised that for all the simplicity, overstatement, and repetition within its records, KISS does make fantastically successful rock. Driven by Gene Simmons' remarkably inventive bass lines and the cacophonous poundings of drummer Peter Criss, KISS makes Chuck Berry chords and basic rock progressions come alive with energetic urgency. Simple, yes. Repetitive, yes sir. But like the Stooges, KISS manages to avoid monotony." The positivity would not last, though the magazine's review of Hotter Than Hell had also been equally favorable. At least there was some support at this critical juncture. The brief outing concluded on February the 22nd at the Omni 41 in Schererville, an ice rink south of Chicago in Indiana. With the group returning to New York the following afternoon, they still had plenty of work to do to wrap up recording the new album. KISS's management, Rocksteady, decided that time was ripe for the group's return to their hometown. By that point, they hadn't played in the city for quite a while. Following their March the 23rd opening slot for Argent at the Academy of Music back in 1974, the closest KISS got to their city was a show in Passaic, New Jersey on October the 25th, as an opener. A special show in the city was a neat tie-in with the fact that the album had been recorded there, and the album's cover featured a picture of the band posing on a New York City street corner. Like their record label, Rocksteady weren't afraid of hyperbole and gambling. How could there be any reward if there was no risk? And by early 1975, there was an abundance of risk for KISS. It was time to make their own luck. Part of that would be embarking on a headlining tour. To kick it off, Rocksteady arranged a gig at the Beacon Theater. J.R. Smalling's day planner suggests that there may have been some rehearsals for the show conducted at the newly opened and more importantly cheap Matrix Studios in Midtown. At $6 an hour, there was a 3-hour booking on March the 10th. They wouldn't have needed much rehearsal time to shake off the cobwebs and rehearse the only song that was really being added to the set. Warm-up gigs for The Beacon Show were booked at the Roxy Theater in Northampton, Pennsylvania, with a pair of shows performed there on March the 19th. Located 6 miles north of Allentown and around 100 miles from the city, the Roxy was a must-play venue in the early 1970s. The group were booked by WSAN's Rick Musselman, though playing double sets had become unusual for the band by this time. But for those 2 days, they didn't have much choice, particularly with the venue boasting only 1,000 seats. That venue had hosted many notable acts, including Rush, Golden Earring, UFO, Aerosmith, Bruce Springsteen, and even Billy Joel. Coming off a nearly month-long live music break, an eternity for Kiss during this period, Peter described the purpose bluntly during Loadout. "We needed to straighten out for Friday. And that's what the show was about prior to the Beacon gig, getting back into shape musically in a situation where only a live audience could have the band releasing the energy that they needed to really perform." Come On and Love Me debuted live in Northampton. While we only have a recording from the second set that night, it's the earliest currently known recording of the song live and marked the debut of new material from the album.
Come on and love me!
Same set was performed during the first show that night. The show itself wasn't tremendously different from the last known set on the Hotter Than Hell tour at Winterland in San Francisco. The first 5 songs in the set remained the same. She, which had been performed during 1974 anyway, returned to the set, replacing Watching You, with Ace's solo being appended to the end. Paul introduced the song as a new one, coming from the new album that would be released the following week.
thing.
The next four songs in the set didn't change from the Hotter Than Hell set list. Only the end of the show was restructured, with Cold Gin closing as the final encore. Come On and Love Me and Let Me Go Rock and Roll preceded it. A planned show on March the 20th at the Shabu Inn in Willimantic, Connecticut proved too much for the schedule and was cancelled. It would have been challenging with the band and crew's health and scheduling pressure to travel 250 miles from Northampton and then a further 150 miles back to New York City with the two shows to perform that Friday. Peter also suggested that the band needed to rest up for the far more important Beacon show. However, they also participated in an assortment of photo shoots on the days prior to the tour starting. These included Stephen Morley's visually appealing shots at Moonstone's boutique store, the waterfall at Pally Park on East 53rd Street between Madison and 5th in Midtown, and the waterfall walkthrough at McGraw-Hill Park on 6th Avenue between 48th and 49th Streets. Some of the shots were used promotionally in support of the new album. But with the album in the can and pending release, everything hinged on the Beacon show. More than just a show, a large contingent of music press had been invited, and the band and label were using it as the launch party for their next phase. Rocksteady planned a smattering of press events with the band around the city. The previously shuttered Fillmore East, which Kiss had used for their press party in January 1974, might have been a consideration for a venue. With its 2,700 seats, it had briefly reopened before closing abruptly in early February. The 3,000-seat venue was a similarly historic venue located at Broadway between 74th and 75th Streets on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. With three levels, it retained its grandeur of a bygone era. Rock concerts had been hosted there from 1974 following a $250,000 renovation, so it was a perfect option. Gene recalled nothing to lose. Ron Delsner didn't want to promote us, so we rented out the Beacon Theater and hired Delsner to promote it. And Ron certainly didn't want to promote the show. It was only with Casablanca guaranteeing it that he took on the gamble. It was one that quickly paid off, with the first show selling out and a second soon being added. Larry Harris recounted in A Party Every Day the inside story of Casablanca Records. Kiss was scheduled to appear at the Beacon Theater in New York, a gig I'd booked myself. Ron Delsner, a big New York promoter, didn't want to book Kiss in the city at all. I told him that if he put them in the Beacon, which only had about 3,000 seats, we'd repay him any money he lost. We had worked with Ron a lot at Buddha, and our relationship was solid. He agreed to the deal. Gene later felt that Ron should have gone big and used the garden. Whatever the case, there was enough hype and Ron was soon converted. He recalled in Nothing to Lose, "They blew me away with their explosions and costumes. It was American theater, and there was a real audience for it. From there, I booked them at the Madison Square Garden and all the big arenas. That experience with Kiss helped me in the sense that I don't listen to hearsay, and I now make sure I see every act myself before I make a decision to book them." Paul looked back on the show in his Face the Music autobiography, commenting, "The Beacon represented a step up. A lot of places we played during our first year of touring were converted movie theaters or vaudeville theaters. They were grand theaters with terrific acoustics, but they were about half the size of the Beacon. The Beacon was so big that the New York promoter Ron Delsner agreed to do the show only if he didn't have to put up any money in advance. He didn't think he'd sell enough tickets to cover a guarantee. But when the tickets went on sale, they sold so quickly that the only way to meet demand was to do two shows in one night. We felt like returning heroes when we came back to the city to headline two shows. We'd gone off boys and come back men. We were a different band, with a lot more experience, and a following that a lot of people, including the New York promoter, didn't realize we had. It felt like a victory parade." The Beacon show also teamed a live cover photographer, Finn Costello, with the band for the first time. Finn recalled to the Kiss Collector fanzine in 2005, "I had only moved to the US a few weeks before that show and was in at AGI with Peter Coriston, who designed Kiss's Dress to Kill album sleeve, working on design ideas for the first Rainbow cover when he asked me if I wanted to see Kiss, who were virtually unknown then outside the New York area, at the Beacon just around the corner. I had been shooting the Brecker Brothers at Todd Rundgren's studio that afternoon, so I had the cameras with me. I've often described it as being akin to the Gates of Hell or Dante's Inferno. They were doing the first number when we came into the back of the theater, and I'd never seen anything like it. Smoke, flames, etc., and the audience going ballistic. See the first tour program for the pictures from that gig. The costumes and the makeup were perfect for the scary theatrical show they had conceived." JoJo Gunn opened the shows. Just over a month earlier, Kiss had opened for them in Santa Monica. It wasn't the last time a previous headliner found themselves on the flip side of the bill with Kiss. Ultimately, Larry Harris's gamble had paid off with the pair of shows scoring 27 of a maximum $30,000 gross. The New York Times covered the show, noting, "Kiss returned to New York at the Beacon Theater, Broadway and 74th Street, and confirmed its status as a genuine headline group and played the same ordinary rock music as before. But for some reason, the effect this quartet has on crowds is quite startling. The whole audience was standing on their seats for the last 45 minutes, an event even in these days of rock emotionalism. Perhaps it is Kiss's kabuki-type makeup. The fact that its four members hurl glitter around and have a controlled fascination with fire and smoke that must dishearten any stage manager. Or perhaps the crowd is driven wild by the drummer's finale as he ascends, kit and all, some 20 feet in the air, while lights flash and smoke billows. More importantly, it is because the musicians of Kiss genuinely enjoy their work. It may be overly simple and unpretentious rock, not so much sung as shouted. But Kiss communicates a sense of fun and commitment to the music. Whatever the cause is, a Kiss concert is certainly a high-energy arena." But before they got too smug, it wasn't all love for the band in their hometown. An album review in their hometown Village Voice noted that Dress to Kill, "It rocks with a brutal, uncompromising force that's very impressive, sort of a slicked down and tightened up MC5. Its lyrics recall the liberal fantasy of rock concert as Nuremberg rally, equating sex with victimization in a display of male supremacism that glints with humor only at its cruelest, for example, song titles like Room Service and Ladies in Waiting. In this context, the band's refusal to bear the faces that lie beneath the clown makeup becomes ominous, and you know damn well that if they didn't have both eyes on what's commercial, they'd call themselves Blowjob." Yeah! The trade press also dutifully reported the show. Variety was kind, noting, "For Kiss, it was an especially big night as the ghoulish glitter rock combo in bizarre kabuki-style garb became the first rock act to sell out the 2,657-seat theater since Ike and Tina Turner scored well over 3 years ago." Additionally, Variety noted, "The two quartets gave their most successful local performances in an ear-shattering rock program." Billboard magazine was also clearly enthusiastic, noting, "As Kiss thundered on stage March the 21st for the first of two shows, it was clearly a case of hail the conquering heroes. The sold-out crowd of hyperactive 16-year-olds rose to their feet as one, cheering and stomping, and remained standing throughout the band's hour-long set. Kiss returned the crowd's fervor with full force, praising their hometown audience and proved to be one of the most energetic groups on the road. The show had very little to do with actual musicianship, since the band operates on a continual pain level volume. However, they were mixed well enough to allow for distinguishable vocals and a few instrumental leads. Kiss's message is a direct one. It plays behind a wall of sound and elicits response according to how familiar one has become with its material. Kiss is a band that so well communicates with its audience as to make the sci-fi freak show an understandable, even necessary element of their performance." Record World noted, "It was a real horror show. If the early show was any indication, Kiss can now lay claim to the title of creme de la creme of the heavy metal groups. Kiss struts leather and chrome in mime whiteface, blasting out anti-cerebral, ultra-visceral nuclear rock as smoke bombs and powder charges explode stage left and stage right. The multitude, as noted by your faithful friend and narrator, was an oddball cross-section of Brooks Brother industry types, gazing in wondrous belief at the sights they beheld. The aforementioned teenage nymphs and any number of refugees from the pages of Roped magazine. One young mistress of discipline was dressed to kill, or for all you Bruce Springsteen fans, like a Harley in heat, in a silver black studded leather suit open to the navel. And of course she carried the mandatory accessory, a whip." Kiss did it up in style. It worked because the guys know what they're doing, they do it well, and they don't make the fatal error of taking themselves too seriously. In other words, they have a sense of humor, which separates them from your run-of-the-mill heavy metalers. Promotional efforts for the release of Dress to Kill were planned, including posters, mobiles, TV spots, radio promo, consumer and trade advertising. But unlike the previous album, at least for this one, it was supported with a single that Casablanca made a concerted effort to push. The promotional plans extended to having Direction Plus create a Kiss clip, which was planned to be a 3-minute TV spot that would promote both the album and serve, as noted in Record World, as a promotional film in the international markets, in addition to the footage being sent to local network television stations in key cities wherever the group was appearing. New costumes were also being designed, but these were initially not ready for use, so the group hit the road with little change from the previous tour. The Dress to Kill tour kicked off in Kenosha, Wisconsin on March the 27th. Crew members headed west the day prior, with the band members flying in the day of show. After just 2 dates, a brief break took place to allow Kiss to fly to California to film an appearance on Burt Sugarman's Midnight Special television program at NBC Studios in Burbank. The band performed 4 songs for studio audience on April the 1st. According to Kiss Alive Forever, Deuce and She were first broadcast on July the 11th. She also included Ace's guitar solo. Funnily, host and DJ, Wolfman Jack, declined to intro the group, instead having one of the other musical guests do so, with Flip Wilson dressing up for the occasion. Leo Sayer recalled to Record Collector magazine in 2024, "You needed a device to get noticed, so I got on stage and tried to be as outlandish as I could, like Alice Cooper. In America, I was guesting on the Midnight Special TV show and introduced Kiss to the world. DJ Wolfman Jack said to me, 'Hey, I don't get these guys, you do it.'" Perhaps foreshadowing the future, Leo was supporting his Just a Boy album at the time. Black Diamond, with a repeat airing of Deuce, were broadcast on November the 28th during show 141 hosted by Helen Reddy. The song included the bombastic set finale with flashbots and levitating drum riser. Peter unleashed his inner Keith Moon and destroyed his drum kit. The bit was stage, according to Gene during the Kissology audio commentary. He noted, "Peter at this point had done exactly as we'd planned, which is throw his drums over. He decides to come back after he's done that and take it to another level by picking up the bass drum and throwing it into the audience. Of course, the next day we had to try to figure out how to get a good drum set, but that was for the next day. But for today, we rocked." And they certainly did. Come and Love Me was never broadcast, and its status is currently unknown, though it is presumed to have been lost or unusable. The video of Black Diamond was included in stunning color on Burt Sugarman's The Midnight Special Legendary Performances 1975 DVD, which was released in 2010. On the Kissology Volume 1 DVD, the video is in black and white, though She switches to color. By April the 4th, the tour had resumed in Michigan. A date booked for the Calderon Concert Hall on Long Island was canceled and rebooked in August. Even at that early stage, there was already discussion of the next project for Casablanca and Kiss, a live album. By early June, Billboard was already reporting. Dave Whitman, engineer at the studio, did a remote with Kiss recently for an upcoming live LP from the group. But that is a story for another day.